Welcome to Coach Aria's podcast, Coach to Lead.
As many of you know, that Peter is not only almost a major sort of architect of the approach known as systemic coaching, he also created the 7-8 model for supervision. He's been a tremendously powerful influence in coaching and mentoring all over the world, especially starting from Europe. He teaches in universities. He was just telling me that over this week, he has been in 5 different webinars and addressing different parts of the world and has been traveling as well. So Peter does not require any introduction. Whatever I have provided is, I think, surplus. As I was telling him, he doesn't need any more credibility and visibility. What we are trying to do is to provide an impact of the wisdom that he has to as large a population as we can in the coaching world. So with that, Peter, over to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ram. And it's a absolute privilege to speaker on this very exciting series that you've done. How do we change coaching from what's been very successful in the 20th century to something that is future fit for the mid 21st century? I'll be talking about how what's got us to here won't get us future fit, how the needs of the world are totally different. And if we don't wake up to that and start to disrupt the coaching industry and revolutionize it, then we will be left behind. So please tighten your seatbelts for a real roller coaster ride. And I'd like to start, close your eyes and make sure both your feet are firmly on the ground. Make sure your seat is firmly back in the chair, your arms resting, relaxed. And to close your eyes and take a big, deep in-breath. And as you take that breath, bring that breath right up to the base of your spine, through your diaphragm and your lungs, through your throat, right up through your head, now to the top of your spine, to connect yourself to the world above you. And then a deep exhale through your mouth, allowing yourself to relax and feeling the energy connecting down right through your body, through your arms resting next to you, through your legs, your feet, to the floor and the earth beneath you. And the second time, I invite you to breathe in, drawing the energy up from the earth, through your legs, through your body. And as you breathe in, please picture all the people that your work serves. Picture a few of your current clients or customers, individuals, teams, people who are colleagues. Picture some future clients and customers, people you'll be working with in the future. And then add to this montage or collage your clients' teams. And imagine the people they work with, their organization. Picture some of the businesses, organizations, governments, voluntary organizations that your clients work for. And then go slightly wider out and picture the stakeholders of those organizations. The organization's customers, employees, investors, partners. Picture the communities, the villages, the towns, the cities where these organizations operate. The economic worlds they support and are supported by. And then go even further out and picture the wider, more than human ecology. The ecological environment that supports and is supported by these organizations. And I would like you, as you hold that great mixture of collage of all the people your work serves, including your own family, children, brothers, sisters, future family, future grandchildren, the generations that come after us. I would like you to ask that great collage of people and environments and systems, what is it they need you to learn that they will get value from you being on this call and having the privilege of this opportunity? What is the question they would like you to ask? What is it they need you to learn that will make the biggest impact to the value you are creating for this wide ecosystem that your work serves? Perhaps choose a few of those stakeholders, future generations, the environment, clients, future clients, organizations. What is it they need you to learn today that will increase the value they get from the work you do? And when you're ready, open your eyes, and I invite you to put into the chat box some of the questions that your stakeholders would like you to be asking, would like you to be thinking about and sharing with this wide community of coaches that we have online from many parts of the world. So please take a big deep out breath, come back into your room. I would like this webinar not just to benefit the 120 people who are online or the many that might hear this on record, but for this to benefit at least 100 stakeholders of everyone who's online. That means, you know, 10,000 people can benefit from this call, not just 120. And thank you for bringing your ecosystem and your stakeholders into the room. And this is something that needs to be the start of every coaching relationship. It needs to be the start of every team coaching relationship, and indeed the start of every coaching supervision session. We need to start not from what the individual wants, but what their world needs the coach and the coachee to work on together to make a bigger difference, a bigger beneficial difference to their wider world. You see, in the last 40 years, and I've had the privilege of being involved with coaching since the late 1970s. And in that time, I've watched with pride how much coaching has achieved. It's now evidence-based, the most popular form of leadership development, the one that's most highly valued by people who are on leadership development programs. We are getting enviable satisfaction ratings from all those people who receive coaching. But as somebody, a colleague said to me recently, who wouldn't feel satisfied by having someone sit and listen to them for an hour? There is far less research to show that the coaching we does makes a difference in terms of outcomes, not just a really interesting conversation in personal development, but outcomes for the wider employees, organizations, and stakeholders. But we've also, in that time, we've taken management and leadership development out of the classroom, looking at growing people's IQ and looking at case studies of the past. And we've helped transform all that development into people having bespoke learning through coaching about their own development, about moving from IQ focused to relationship skills and EQ focused. And in the time when I was first a leader, I would often jokingly say that most of us managers and leaders had IQs that were 10 times greater than our EQs. And I think we've seen a big shift in that. In the last 10 years, I've worked in 50 different countries. And around the world, I see much greater relational skills and emotional skills in many managers and leaders than my generation had. However, today I'm going to argue that if the last 40 years was about moving from IQ to EQ, the next 20 years needs to be about moving from IQ to WeQ, or collaborative intelligence. Also in that time, we've seen the growth of internal coaching communities, managers learning coaching skills, the growth of coach supervision, raising the quality in the continuing learning of all coaches. And we've seen the growth of team coaching and systemic team coaching. So we've achieved a lot. Indeed, I used to also say when I was first in coaching that coaching was a way of outsourcing difficult conversations, where if a manager didn't want to have a difficult conversation with one of their team, they would ring up HR. If HR didn't want to have that conversation, they would ring up an executive coach. And now I'm pleased to say we are re-insourcing those conversations. But now we need to ask, so what is it that very experienced coaches need to move on to? So let me quote probably the most well-known coach in the world right now, Marshall Goldsmith. What got you to here won't get you to there. I think that's true not only as individuals or as teams, but it's true for us as a profession. The next 20 years is going to need something radically different than the last 40. So let me share some of my wake-up calls. I'm going to share three of them that have helped me realize why a revolution is necessary. The first was early in 2009. I've been looking at what was going on with the banking crisis and what was going on with the economic crisis that we experienced late 2008, early 2009. And I was shocked to discover that Lehman Brothers in America, the Royal Bank of Scotland in the UK, Barclays, many of the leading banks that drove off the cliff had spent a fortune on executive coaching. I also went on to discover so had Enron and Andersons and British Petroleum, not just the banks. And that didn't stop them driving off the cliff into an organizational catastrophe. And I asked the question at this conference, I said, what were the coaches doing while the banks were burning? And somebody put their hand up at the back and said, well, it's obvious what the coaches were doing while the banks were burning. I said, what were they doing? He said, they were quickly sending in their invoices in order to ensure they got paid. And everyone laughed. And I started to laugh, and then I gulped. I thought, what does that say about our profession? A couple of years later, I was down in South Africa, where I've done quite a lot of work since the changes in 1994, 1995. And I was working with the whole region of Cape Town and the Western Cape. They'd done some brilliant work to develop a coaching culture strategy. And I said, let's bring all your stakeholders together and you can present the strategy and get feedback from all your stakeholders. That included taxpayers, service users, schools, hospitals, senior leaders, middle leaders, frontline leaders. And we even had some people role play and step into the role of the wider environment, the ecology of the Western Cape, and some to play the collective grandchildren of the Western Cape. What did the future need us to be developing today that their future would be better, not worse? Feedback from the stakeholders. And I should never forget the moment when a young frontline manager stood up, tall, young, black man. And he said, well, I listen to this. It sounds like those with the big paychecks, the big offices, the big cars, now get the big coaches. If I listen to this, he said, it sounds like coaching is very expensive personal development for the already highly privileged. And that hit me in the gut. I thought, is that what I'm spending my life doing? Very expensive personal development for the already highly privileged? Is that what I want to be doing? And then my third wake up was earlier this year. My colleague Zoe Cohen, and by the way, if you go onto the ICF UK site, there is a webinar I did earlier this week with Zoe on how to become climate conscious coaches. And she wrote a blog in January which said, what were all the coaches doing when the planet warmed by 3 degrees. And here on the slide, I've put data not from some campaigning organization, but from the BBC Climate Action Tracker. The world talks about we have to stay beneath 1.5 degrees temperature rise. And yet, based on current pledges, we're going to hit 2.9 unless those pledges change. And by the way, the latest data that I read this week shows that no country is actually fulfilling their pledges. If we go on current policies of politicians, we're going to hit 3.3. And if we continue the way we're acting today, we're going to exceed 4 degree temperature rise. And I just encourage you, please go and look at the scientific data on what 4 degrees looks like. It is horrifying. It's unlikely at 4 degree temperature rise that human life will be able to exist on this planet. Even at 2.9 and 3.3, we're going to have major ecological devastation. We have an urgent climate emergency. And yet, you know, on that webinar, I asked somebody who was at the ICF Global Conference in Prague. I said, how many workshops and how many talks talked about climate conscious coaching? The answer was zero. We as a profession are being willfully blind to the challenges that the world is facing. So I started to ask the question, how could coaching really change to provide real impact and beneficial impact beyond personal development for the already highly privileged? How can we look at getting not just the individual's needs into the room, but the stakeholders' needs? And how do we help people see the stakeholders they are unaware of or willfully blind to? And how do we wake up to the needs of the future and move coaching from dealing with yesterday's problems to more focused on growing our capacity and shifting our human consciousness to deal with the challenges of tomorrow? And at the same time, there are major disruptors that are affecting our industry. I've already mentioned coaching being reinsourced, first to internal coaches and then to leaders and line managers. How we've now got coaching bots and coaching apps that have stored all the best coaching questions in the world. We've got apps that can read the emotional mood. We've got artificial intelligence empathy. And they can match their tonality to the caller. We've got organizations that are doing coaching on demand. When I did a research program on tomorrow's leadership and the necessary revolution in leadership development, many millennials said to me, listen, you know, we don't wait a month to go and have a one-to-one coaching session. If we've got an issue, we put it out on WhatsApp to all our mates or Instagram or any of those apps. We need coaching at the time we need it. We're the generation that don't worry about working out an answer. We just go onto Google. So our whole marketplace is changing. The growth of peer coaching, self-coaching. And also in that research, we discovered that I talked to 50 companies around the world across all sectors. We interviewed a CEO, an HR director, and a millennial future leader. And all the CEOs said in the next 5 to 10 years, we'll be employing less people because of robotics, outsourcing, digitalization. But they said, the number of people we will need to partner with will get greater and more complex. So we need to realize that the whole world around us and the nature of leadership is changing. We're moving from 20th century heroic leaders to 21st century collective and collaborative leadership. We're moving from thinking about leadership vertically, who do I report to, who reports to me, to how do we create horizontal connection across the organization and across the boundaries of the organization to all our stakeholders. It's not about leading myself, leading my team, leading my function, leading my organization. It's how do I create horizontal change across boundaries. So we need to ask this question, and I'll pause in a moment, Ram, for some questions, but what is it that coaching can uniquely do, not that keeps it in business, but that the world of tomorrow needs? How do we gear up today, not tomorrow, but today, for those tomorrow's needs? So Ram, what sort of questions have been coming in?
Yeah, I should start from the time that you asked the question quickly, and you can select. One of the first questions was, how will I be able to support them to become self-sufficient, self-reliant? How can I help them open their eyes wider of the potential of team members, especially those who are less visible in the organization? How do we permeate our culture for trust, integrity, etc.? There are a couple of questions which resonated for me. How do I enable them to be happier and happier forever? How do I enable them to be ready for a future they don't even know anything about? How can we create an ecosystem that is free of discrimination? Let me stop there and maybe some of these. I mean, there are zillions of them. So we can, after you answer some of these, and if you have the time, we can take some more.
Some great questions. Let me just take a couple of those before I go on to the next group of slides. How do we support them to be self-reliant? Often I run these trainings. Ram mentioned I'm coming to India to run one. I've run them in America, China, South Africa, all around Europe, in systemic team coaching. And people often ask me, how long is a systemic team coaching program? My answer is always, systemic team coaching, and the same applies to systemic coaching, never ends. It only transitions from being done by a professional external coach to being done by the team itself. Therefore, one of the deliveries of every coaching program needs to be to leave the individual or the team we're coaching able to carry on coaching themselves effectively. Coaching never ends, it only transitions who's doing it. I will be coming on to talk about how the coaching, even from the word go, is not just done by the coach. The other ones, I was very struck by, how do we leave everyone happier? The lovely phrase that my original psychodrama teacher taught me, 40 years ago plus, she said, a mother is as happy as her most unhappy child. And I've always thought about that phrase, a mother is only as happy as her most unhappiest child. And I wondered whether we can't translate that into, we can only be as happy as our most unhappiest stakeholder. To be happy, I need to make my stakeholder world, my ecosystem, healthy and happy. You see, I think we've got caught in a very Western, egocentric, individualist culture where over the last 40 years, my generation has been trying to find the fastest individual escalator up the Maslow pyramid. How do I get to my physical and financial security? How do I get to be loved and liked? How do I get to become self-actualized? We've seen this as an individual benefit journey, not as a collective journey. I can only be as happy as my most unhappiest stakeholder. How do I not think about individual happiness, but collective healthiness? Let me just take another one. I mentioned the climate crisis, and when I first brought that up at a coaching conference, several people said, we know through our ICF competencies, we must leave our agenda outside the door. It's not our job to bring the ecology into the coaching room. And I said, that's a very interesting belief system. The notion that the ecology is not already in every coaching room. I said to them rather provocatively, are you telling me your clients don't eat, don't breathe, and that you don't eat and breathe? Because if you do, the ecology is present in every coaching room. And it's not only physically present in that way and affected by our journey to work, what we do, but it's also present. There's a new term called eco-anxiety. Every coachee I meet now, I recognize not only myself, but they are suffering either consciously or unconsciously from eco-anxiety. The concern of what's happening to their children, going to schools in polluted areas, They're concerned about what's happening for the next generation, what they see on the news or what's happening to the oceans or the Amazon burning. I think eco-anxiety is current in every coaching conversation. So how do we open our eyes to that? Very practically, I will be coming on to how do we need to start a coaching relationship that means the stakeholders are in the room metaphorically from day one, from the first minute. And I'll come back to that. And this last question about the futures they don't even know about. You see, it's so easy. I still meet it in many, many conversations. People talk about the environment as though it exists out there and that we're not part of it. The environment is in us as much as we're in the environment. And they talk about these challenges as being something for the future. You know, that the climate emergency is something future generations will face. It's already here. Every aspect of the future is already happening somewhere in the world. So we have to, it's not that we have to challenge our clients more, but we have to bring the challenge that's coming over the horizon, that's out there in the stakeholder worlds, into the coaching room. You know, interestingly, the research we did on senior coaching clients, the biggest thing they wanted different from their coaches was more challenge. And then I think coaches get into a difficulty of how do I challenge more without bringing in my agenda? That's what we need to learn. How do we bring the challenge that's already in their ecosystem into the room? So I would do it by asking questions like, what are you going to regret in 2 years' time not having explored in this coaching relationship? What would your stakeholders most value us, you and I, working on? These are future back and outside in questions, not what do you want from coaching? But let me get, Rab, is there any other kind of comeback that's happened that I should respond to before moving on to the second section?
There's a kind of a thread of few people in terms of how do you get people who are CEOs, CXOs, and so on to realize that they are the ones who are really in need of coaching and not just the people down the line believing that they want others to change, but they don't need to change themselves.
So it's a lovely question. I spent many years being called in by senior teams to say, will you help us with leadership development? And I would always reply, yes, what do you want to develop? And they would say to me, no, not us. Please develop the third tier. And because I wanted the work, I would go and set up trainings for the third level of leadership. And at the first workshop, they would always say to me, why are you starting with us? It's them that you need to start with. And I would always say you're both half wrong, right? Because actually what needs developing is not just them at the top or them further down. It's how do we change the connection between them, the vertical connection and the horizontal connection. When I did this research 2 years ago, right around the world, one CEO said to me, Peter, I've got lots of coaches who coach my people. I've got lots of consultants who consult to parts of my organizations, but that's not where the real challenges lie. He said, all my major challenges lie in the connections. And actually what we're lacking is coaches who can coach the connections between them and them, between them and them. And I will be saying a little bit about how we have to move even beyond team coaching to team of teams coaching. So we're coaching the connections between teams, between functions, between the organization and their stakeholders. That's what the world's crying out for. But when I start to ask this question, and my favorite coaching question is always to an individual, what can you uniquely do that the world of tomorrow needs? So that our coaching is purpose-led, not desire-led, personal want-led. I've been using that question for many years, and people said to me, so what's your answer? This was about nearly 10 years ago. And I just sold my consultancy business. I was choice rich. When people asked me, well, what was my answer? What could I uniquely do? I had to go away on retreat for 5 days to answer my own question. And when I was on retreat, I realized these five little people were the people who were keeping me working. I could have retired at that stage. Instead, I realized to retire would be to let these little people down. These are my five grandchildren, Iris, Florence, Nancy, Charlie, and Freddie. And today my wife's gone up to meet three of those. I should have been with her, but decided I needed to have this talk instead. So I have to make sure this talk is worthwhile so I can answer. I decided to be working not just, as one accountant suggested, to support their parents' housing costs, they were keeping me working because I knew we were leaving them a more complex and more challenging future than my generation had faced. And if they came back to me and asked me, you know, what were you doing in this time of the great turning? What were you doing, Grandpa, to prepare the next generations for the world you were leaving them? A world of greater challenge, much greater population, 3 times bigger population than when you were born. What were you doing when there were growing expectations and diminishing resources? What were you doing to prepare us? And I think as a whole leadership development, coaching, consultancy industries, we are all failing the next generations. You see, leadership needs to radically move. That's 20th century leaders, heroic and individualistic, being coached on how they become charismatic and how they present well, experts in their sector, working on predictability, what they already know, focused on the last and the next quarter, to collaborative team coaching. The heroic leader is dead, I wrote 10 years ago, long live the team. Leadership that can collectively lead across boundaries. One CEO that I was talking to in the research said, Peter, leadership today is like flying an aircraft at 40,000 feet and having to rebuild that aircraft mid-flight, coordinate the team on the flight deck, coordinate the cabin crew, manage the disruptive passengers, talk to ground control, and watch the climate coming over the horizon. That's what leadership is like today. It's no longer possible for the only point of integration to be the CEO. We need leadership teams at all levels that don't just manage their part of the system, but take collective responsibility for making the whole more than the sum of the parts. And leadership that's growing the capacity, the greater capacity of the organization to face the greater challenges tomorrow. I was back in South Africa a couple of years ago, talking to 400 leaders from across Southern Africa. And I asked them at the beginning of the talk, please stand up, all of you leaders who are responsible for developing the next generation of leadership across Southern Africa. And about a third of the people stood up. They were the HR directors, the people who taught at business schools, the people in charge of leadership development. And I said, no, let me repeat the question. I was not clear. You didn't hear me properly. Stand up if you're responsible for developing the next generation of leadership across Southern Africa. And just over half stood up. And I had to ask a third time until everyone stood up and realized it is all our responsibility. We cannot outsource this to business schools, to coaches, to leadership development firms. We all are part of creating the next generation of leadership to deal with the world we're leaving them. And part of that is leadership that can operate in 3 time horizons. And this I'm introducing because it means coaching has to hold those 3 time horizons in every coaching conversation. Horizon one is business as usual. Today's problems, everything that comes, you know, across the email, across the telephone, in meetings, keeping the wheel turning, delivering this quarter's results. Horizon two is about how are we innovating and changing the processes for tomorrow. And horizon three is what time are we spending on future foresight? What's coming over the horizon? Where is the future already existing in the world that we need to wake up to? And you might think, each of you who are listening, what percentage of your coaching time is spent in each of those horizons? Horizon one, fixing the problems of today or yesterday, changing the whole processes and engagement, and innovating for tomorrow, and how much time is spent on future foresight. Bill Sharp, who wrote this lovely little book called Three Horizons, argues, we now need to change the order we're doing these in. Because if we innovate in horizon two out of horizon one, we're just learning to become better and better at playing yesterday's game. We're not growing the capacity to play tomorrow's game. Thus, we need to do horizon two out of horizon three thinking. So that's a challenge for every coaching assignment and every team coaching assignment. So what is systemic team coaching? First of all, it recognizes that coaching is not done by the coach. It's a collaborative and dialogical inquiry between two people in service of their wider stakeholder community. It's not dyadic, it's triadic. It's co-created between, if I'm coaching Ram, It's not me doing the coaching. It's not just Ram and I doing the coaching, but it's Ram, the curriculum that life is setting Ram constantly, the new challenges that are coming over the horizon. It's Ram's ecosystem, Ram and myself, who are doing the coaching. It's a triangle, not a dyad. It's recognizing that there's no such thing as personal development or team development, because all development is relational between any system and its wider system that it's nested within. And that business systemic coaching and systemic coaching needs to be focusing on creating value, not just for the individual, not just for their team, not just for the organization, but the whole stakeholder world. As I said earlier, we need to realizing that we need to coach the connections, not just the people. To move from IQ, not only from IQ to EQ, but IQ to WeQ. And as I discovered when I was recently in Japan, always focus not on a win-win, but a win-win-win. Not just a win for the coachee, not just a win for their direct relationships, but a win for what that leader, their team, their colleagues need to create for the people their work serves. So I'm going to introduce five or six kind of very simple steps that I think we need in order to do this work. And by the way, if you go onto my website at Renewal Associates, there's an article I read about 3 years ago called Cracking the Shell. Seven things that you get taught on every coach training that you need to unlearn in order to work systemically. So part of our work is how do we shift our own consciousness in order to do systemic coaching rather than personal development? The first thing we have to unlearn, we're taught the client is the person opposite me. And I'm saying we have to unlearn that. No, the client is not the person opposite us. That's our coaching partner. The client is their stakeholder world. I need to consider only their agenda of what they want. No, we shouldn't be on the coachee's agenda or the coach's agenda. We should be on the agenda that life is presenting. I need to leave my experience outside the coaching room. I've always had a problem with that because I've never discovered the place I meant to park my experience. I don't know how to take it out of me. Yeah, my experience is part of me. And I believe our clients need all of our skills and all of our experience. We shouldn't be on our agenda, but we should be bringing our experience to the party. The fourth one, we get really tied up with the notion that all interventions are questions. And I've discovered over 40 years that a lot of the best interventions, some of which are nonverbal, some of which are not questions, they're joining words. And people say, you know, I need to communicate better. I will say to, about. Some interventions are not questions. They're half sentence that we give our client to complete. And some are a nonverbal echoing. The fifth one, I should never interrupt. I don't know about any of you, but I've had some clients that if I did interrupt them, I would spend 60 minutes just listening to their well-grooved stories and helping them believe their own narratives even stronger at the end of the hour than they did at the beginning. You see, I think sometimes we need to interrupt. I'll give you with reframes. If you listen to a person sitting there talking about how awful their organization is, how they're just the victim of their organizational processes. I believe that every minute you listen to that, you are helping them feel more powerless, to feel less empowered. So when a client says to me, Peter, you can't do that in my organization, I will say, not yet. I will find short ways of offering reframes in the midst of what they're saying that help them take themselves back to new possibilities. The sixth one, we should always end with an action plan. We, in the early days of coaching supervision, we brought together a lot of the early coach supervisors. This is about 20 years ago. And we asked what patterns were coming up in supervision from coaches. And do you know, it'd be very interesting to guess what was the most common issue that people were bringing to supervision as coaches? The most common issue was, we had a great session. They had an aha moment. They left with an action plan. And then the supervisor will say, yes, that's great. They'll say, no, it wasn't great, because they came back a month later and they hadn't done what was in their action plan. It's the same with offsite sessions for teams. They leave with lots of good intentions, They make lots of agreements. But when I did the research on this, only a small fraction of what they agree to on the offsite or in the coaching session translates into change back at work. But what was interesting is at that point, many of the coaches blamed the client. They said, oh, they weren't committed enough. They weren't courageous enough. Rather than ask the question, what do we need to do differently? We have an old English phrase which says, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And we could add to that in coaching, the road to hell is paved with aha moments, good intentions, and action plans. We have a phrase that says, if the change doesn't start in the coaching room or the offsite team coaching, it won't happen back at work. You see, change is done, good intentions are done with the neocortex and words. Change is always embodied. We need to get people to not just tell you about what they're going to do differently, but to show you, to do fast forward rehearsals, to take the learning from the neocortex into embodied change in the coaching room or the team coaching workshop. We need to actually also coach people live at work, actually at their team meetings, not just at offsites. We need to move from talking about change to embodied difference. And seventh, coaching is only about personal development. Well, hopefully I've already showed that actually personal development is a miasma. It doesn't really exist. Let me come to the six steps. The first I've already talked about. If I'm working with Ram, rather than facing him as I am now over the screen, it's a bit more difficult virtually, but I found ways of doing it. We have to go shoulder to shoulder. What I do now virtually is I bring up a blank screen that we can both write on, which you can do with modern technology, so that we are partners in the coaching process. From the word go, I would say to Ram, Ram, tell me about you. Then I'd ask, tell me about what really matters to you. What is it you're most committed to in your life? What's the difference you want to make? Who does your work serve? And then I would metaphorically invite those people into our coaching conversation. I'd say, Ram, if the people you work with in Coacharia, the people who listen in, if they were all in the room right now, your family, Ram, what is the work they would be suggesting that you and I need to do together, that they would get benefit from our coaching work? What is the work that they're needing that you can't do by yourself and I can't do for you, but together, if we focus on, we can make a difference to? So this way, right from the word go, we are starting in triangulation, not in seeing you as the customer and me as the supplier of coaching. You see, I used to, for many years, ask these rather dumb coaching questions. I would look Ram in the eye and say, what do you want from coaching, Ram? And you know, even the way I was asking was a pretty dumb way of asking, because if I look you in the eye, Ram, and say, what do you want from coaching? I do two things. First of all, I activate your left hemisphere neocortex, which is probably the least able part of you to respond. And secondly, Ram, I put you back into being at school, being asked a question by a teacher. And can I just ask you, when you were asked a question when you were at school by a teacher, what happened? What response did you have when a teacher looked you in the eye and said, and asked you a question?
Yes, Peter, you want me to answer that question?
Yeah, what happened when you were at school and a teacher looked at you and asked you a question?
Having been educated in India, maybe 6 years ago or more, that teacher, if I asked any question, probably would cane me and tell me to sit down.
And yeah, but what happened when they decided to ask you a question in front of the class?
If rarely they did, but if they did ask me a question, very often I would get thrown out of the class because what I said would not quite agree with what they would have said.
The answer.
I was okay. A member. Yeah.
So most of us have been through this school experience. You know, when I ask this question of several people, and I say, you know, what happened when people ask you a question? You can all think about this. People would say, either I froze, I went blank, or I tried to come up with the right answer. There's a few people like Ram who come up with the left field answer and then get thrown out of the class. I would then ask people, well, what's the right answer? The right answer is the one that the teacher's already thought of. And hypnotically, we put people back into that situation. So We say, what do you want from coaching? And they think, oh, what am I meant to say? Oh, please help me with my relationships. Please help me develop my relational skills and my communication skills. Yeah, they come up with the answer they think they're meant to come up with, or they go blank. I used to ask them, you know, what were the goals for the coaching? Well, most people don't know. What do you want to talk about in this session? I'm not interested in what my clients want to talk about any longer. I'm interested in what life needs us to be talking about. And, you know, it took me 20 years of coaching to realize that that wasn't a very good way to start coaching. It took me another 5 or 6 years to realize that even at the end of sessions, I would end by saying, so what's been helpful, Ram, from this session, and what could be more helpful next time? And I realized, I thought I was asking for feedback as the coach, continuous improvement. I realized I wasn't asking for feedback. I was asking for reassurance. How do I know that? Because my clients would say, oh, it's all been helpful. Just do more of the same. So clearly I was not asking for feedback. You see, I also, by asking that question, was arrogantly stepping back into the idea that I'd done the coaching and you'd been the customer, rather than we, you and I, Ram, and life had been doing the coaching together. And a bit later on, I'll talk about how I've changed that ending. Because these are some of the things I would say now. Ram, tell me about you. What do you most care about? Who does your work serve? What would those people say is the work we need to do together in this coaching? I might also put in some others, like I mentioned earlier, what would you regret not having done in 2 years' time? What would you regret not having explored in this coaching together? What is life knocking on your door and asking you to step up to? These are all future back outside in systemic questions. And I might say, who does your work serve? And then I might ask, and which stakeholders are you not noticing in your life right now? I might also ask and even bring in some of the stakeholders that are clearly part of your life, like what about your future clients? What about the wider communities where you live? What about the more than human environment? If they were in the room, your environment was in the room, what's the work they would need us to do together? So I'm not bringing in my agenda, but I'm helping you see the stakeholders that you may be either unaware of or willfully blind to. Some people know I have this concept of the 13th fairy, and every organization I've worked with has a 13th fairy. It comes from the story of the Brothers Grimm, Sleeping Beauty, who, because the 13th fairy was not invited to the christening party, became the one that caused the problems. Every organization has the stakeholder they're not noticing is important, and it's that stakeholder that will come to bite them in the bum, or, as happened in the story, prick them in the thumb. I give the example often of British Petroleum did not realize that fishermen on the East Coast of America were an incredibly important stakeholder into the Gulf oil disaster. And then those fishermen nearly brought the largest UK capitalized company into administration through political campaigns, through the fact that their whole industry had been ruined, through massive fines, political action. So be aware of the stakeholder you're not bringing into the coaching room. And then I end now, not by saying, Ram, please tell me what's been helpful, what could be more helpful, and going back into supplier mentality, but bringing two or three of the stakeholders you've introduced and saying, look, Ram, if your family was in the room, if your future Coacharia trainees were in the room, what would they have valued about the work you and I have done together in this hour? And what would their challenge be to us? What would they ask us to be doing differently as we continue the coaching? So the stakeholder's voice is always with us in the work. And then the second thing I think we need to do is we need to listen systemically. We need to not only listen to the client and their story, and remember it is just their story, but we need to listen empathically to their story and their nonverbal harmonics, to listen with our body, not just with our ears in our neocortex. We also need to be able to go onto the balcony and watch what's going on live, not about them just talking about their relationships out there, but what's happening in our relationship here. We also need to very carefully have wide-angled empathy, not just personal empathy. You see, as coaches, we're trained to have enormous empathy for the person in the room for us. But the problem is we then listen to their story as though their story is reality, not just their story. We start to hear about all the other people in their lives. And at worst, we hear their organization is persecutor, them is victim, and we become rescuer. We try and support them against this awful organization. And we need to have as much empathy for everyone in their story and every system in their story as we do for them. We need to listen to the needs of the stakeholders and the wider field in ecology. And we need to listen to the lessons that life is presenting them with as lessons, not as problems to be fixed. I often say, look, there's three questions we should always hold in mind. What's disconnected that needs connecting in the wider world? What's the shift that needs to be enabled in this coaching room to create a shift outside the room? And what's the truth that needs to be surfaced here? That means we need to be really skilled at multi-stakeholder contracting, not just bringing in the boss or doing interviews for a 360 degree feedback and asking the boss, what does RAM need to learn? Because mostly I've discovered the bosses become very patronizing and say, oh, please help them, you know, work better with their colleagues or something simplistic and patronizing. We need to have ways of looking with the stakeholders, 3-4-way meetings, the boss, the HR, the coach, future boss, the coachee. What's going to make this coaching valuable, not just for the person to do a better job they're currently doing, but to be ready for their next job? What's going to make this coaching valuable for this person's team, for their organization, for the stakeholders? And how are you, the boss, HR, the sponsor, how are you going to be part of ensuring and contributing to that impact and enabling whatever comes out of this coaching to really have a very big impactful ripple effect? And in this book, I've just finished with Eve Turner. There's also an article that's already published, but we've got a book coming out December 19th that goes into this in detail and ways of doing it. And then once we've done the contracting, we need to revisit that, not just at the end of the coaching, but throughout the coaching, with how are we going to evaluate that this is having a benefit, not just for the individual, but for the others. Another very simple thing we could do is get the stakeholders' voice into the room. Coaching, hold them in mind, asking future back outside in questions, but also using empty chairs. I'd really invite everyone who's listening to if you've got a coaching room that's only got two chairs in it, bring in some more chairs so that we can have a place for the stakeholders to be located, if only metaphorically. One of the simple things I do with boards and executive teams I work with, and you can do this with your teams, is I bring in empty chairs, and one says our customers, one says our employees, one says our investors, one says the environment, and one says our future generations. And if there's a really big issue of strategy in the boardroom, I say, all right, get out of your chairs and go and sit in those chairs and comment on the conversation you've just heard from the shoes and the voice of that stakeholder. Let's have multiple chairs, even in the individual coaching room. And what also is important, that we have fast forward rehearsals. We don't just talk about the change, we start to enact it. So if I've got those chairs in the room, I might say, look, you've told me you need to have a different conversation with your CEO. So let's imagine it's already next Tuesday, it's already 4:00. Show me how you're going to start that conversation. Put them on the chair and let's rehearse that. And then I'll give you some direct feedback as if you like, the coaching, the live coaching coach. Not coaching in the club room, but coaching on the pitch. The fifth thing I'd encourage us all to do, and there's a whole chapter in our new book on this, is to be not only ecologically conscious and aware coaches, but eco-engaged in our coaching. So in that very opening of our first chemistry session, to ask, how is this coaching going to affect not just your organization, your stakeholders, but the wider ecological environment? And how does that need to be present in our work together? How do we make sure that we've got openings to the wider environment in our coaching rooms, the view from the window, objects, flowers? How do we more bring the presence of the environment, not just for us to focus on, but as a resource for our work? how do we, and we give lots of examples in the book of moving from just coaching in airless offices to coaching walking alongside our clients, our coachees, and using the environment as part of the coaching resource, as well as something we awaken them to. So now every year I run advanced coaching retreats here in Bath, and I'm very fortunate to look out across beautiful countryside and have a woodland. And I train people to walk in pairs side by side and to use the trees, to use the three horizons in terms of what's right in front of them, how is the path opening up, is horizon two, and what do they see on the horizon three? To use the natural resources as part of our coaching process, to ask the ecology to do the coaching and not just be a recipient of coaching. We give examples of using animals and other living beings, equine-assisted, even elephant-assisted coaching. But also it means we have to do our own work. We have to go through this process and then help our clients go through from ecological denial, through the grief, pain, and trauma of realizing what we as a species are doing to ourselves and the wider ecosystem. The 50% of animal species that have gone extinct in the last century, the environments that have no longer become habitable or sustainable. Then we have to work through how that often leads to anger and blame, blaming someone else, blaming another country, another president, another politicians, to then re-owning that and going through our own guilt and shame that gets brought up when we realize that we're all responsible. So then looking at it, it's only then can we start to take personal responsibility and see, yes, if I don't see that I'm part of the causation, I can't fully be part of realizing I'm part of the solution and way forward. And then finding new ways of bringing that wider environment into all the work we do. There is an open letter now that's been signed by a number of leading coaches to all the coaching professions and all the coach training bodies, talking about practical steps we can all do to declare climate emergency as part of the coaching profession, and to look at how we as privileged people who've had not only great intellectual education, but great emotional education and great trainings and great access to a wide range of people, what we can do with that privilege to make the most difference. And in our book, in the final chapter, we give all sorts of examples of coaches who are now realizing that their work needs to not only impact their individual and their team clients, but are finding ways of taking that into whole new fields. So now we come to back to the next generation questions that we can use to change the way we engage. And let me just share one of my favorite quotes that I use all around the world. It's from an American professor, Gordon Alport, who went and dropped out of Yale and went to India to learn spiritually. And he studied with many, many great spiritual teachers, Buddhist, Hindu, Sikh. One of his great teachers was a great Sikh guru. And he became a spiritual teacher himself called Ram Dass. And when he came back to the West, he said, "It's amazing how many of us sign up at the school of life and then spend our lives complaining about the curriculum. We have all signed up at the school of life. Life is constantly throwing up new curriculum for us, but we're often resisting it. So how do we make our coaching be assisted by the curriculum that life is presenting, not the problems we want to fix?" And I've added to that sentence of Ram Dass rather arrogantly. I said, "The generous thing about life, Ram, is that in life there are endless re-examinations. What we fail to learn in one role or with one team, we can guarantee that life will give us a new opportunity in the next role and the next team. What we fail to learn in one marriage, after a very expensive divorce, life will give us the same examination in the next marriage. So our job is not to be on their agenda or our agenda, but the agenda that life is generously providing for us." So let me come back after that impassioned revolutionary plea, Ram, to what are the questions and comments that are coming in?
I want to say a couple of things, Peter. One is to tell the audience a little bit about the Peter that I met, and also It's been an awe-inspiring speech, the delivery. You know, there are quite a few things about comments about ICF. If we were to ask the kind of questions that Peter said to ask, would we get our credentials? Actually, you know, it's a bit funny. Yes, at the levels of, let's say, the PCC markers and so on in ICF and EMCC, whatever the competencies are, it serves a purpose in terms of instilling in us certain competency framework, and we learn that. But truly, at the mastery level, whether it's ICF or EMCC, allows you to break out into much larger space. And there, whatever you said, those questions can still be addressed, and those are enormously meaningful. The couple of points that you made about the weak you, how do we relate to not just the IQ, the other, as well as, and the point that you made about the relationship and addressing the space between us, between one and the other, and the larger space of the system. I think unbelievable. I think it's going to take us a long time for many of us to digest what it is. But what I really would request you is, in the about 10 odd minutes left, and I just want to say a couple of words more. Maybe one experience that stands out for you as a case where you have been able to make this huge difference. But what I would like to say to the audience is that, Peter, I met. I took a train from London to Bath, where Peter lives in his, 300 acres estate, organic farm as far as eyes can see, and it's got an Enneagram garden in it. And he has people from all over the world at the time. And I went there, there was someone from Spain, someone from Israel, someone else who had come there to intern with him, like he said, walking. But they were also there working there for him to weed the garden, plant the seeds, and also probably collect the fruits and so on and so forth. The life that he leads is a very great example of what he's talking about here. And of course, I met his wife, and he has this huge library. And as I was going through it, I found a huge collection of Hindu, Buddhist, Sufism. And I learned that he was tutored, mentored, probably kind of a guru, of the grandson of a great Sufi master whose tomb is in Nizamuddin near in New Delhi. And that is something that he comes very often to, many of these things. And so that's one of the reasons why we really want to get him to India and have him do a program next year. And I hope many of you would be able to attend that. And he cooked me this fabulous dinner. He did it himself. It was, if I remember right, a salmon and wine. And so we had an amazing dinner, and he dropped me back to the station. So it was unbelievable to someone he really didn't know too much about before, the kindness that he showed, the hospitality, and that radiated from this person. And that's what I see radiating here in a very, very systemic way to all of us in terms of how we can grow and how we can help coaching grow. So in about 10 minutes, Peter, if you would like to really probably adding great value to everybody here, is an experience that you might like to share as a case.
Well, thank you, Ram, and thank you for your kind words. Just to say, it's not 300, it's only 37 acres, but it's still a small farm. And I think there is something very important. You know, people say, you know, I'm sure next year will be 70. And people say, well, how do you have so much energy? And I say, well, you get the energy from the world out there. And one of the things is not just from the many groups I engage with around the world, but the energy from the more than human world, from being out working the garden, from turning the compost, which is the heart of the garden. And how do we, I wrote a chapter for a book last year, which was all about how do we work and do this work from source rather than from effort? How do we not do it from, you know, our toolkit, from our neocortex, but how do we work from source and realizing we're not doing the coaching? It's not just us in the coachee. It's not just us in the agenda and the coachee. Actually, we are being resourced by life that is doing the coaching through us and with us. So I just wanted to mention that. You ask about experiences. You know, there are a number that I share in the book. One of my great privileges was to work with the fruit industry of South Africa. And I was working with the two big fruit industries that have been outsourced, that have been deregulated in the change in the apartheid regime. And they handed over the ownership to the big Afrikaner farmers, so that they now owned the big marketing entities. And they're lovely people, but they weren't known for having a major global mindset. They were people whose real interest was about their local community and the price of fruit at their gate. And I was then in a lovely challenge of, you know, it's not my job to help them to wake up to what they're not seeing, by bringing in answers or bringing in what I'm seeing, but how do I get them to wake up to a world they're not seeing? How do we bring in those incredible stakeholders? And I just decided really early on, I worked with this organization and I worked through a merger with them and I worked through coaching their board, their top team, several parts. I worked with their marketing entities in various parts of the world, coaching those marketing teams, but also coaching the space between them. And it was an enormous privilege. I also went and worked with some of the cooperatives, fruit cooperatives and packing stations in the local areas. And I worked with the organization coaching the relationship between them and the major supermarkets, because now it was owned by the farmers, but the real power was with the retailers. And how did we, you know, work right across that whole value chain? And one of the most moving times was we did a board, the second time I coached the board, we did it in Cape Town. And we took the board members and their wives to Robben Island. And I traveled around Robben Island, been taken around by an ex-prisoner. And many of these board members had been part of the Broederbond, had been sons and daughters of apartheid leaders. And suddenly this whole emotional experience of going around Robben Island and hearing from an ex-prisoner was deeply eye-opening and traumatic. And I was up to about 3 a.m. just dealing with the emotions that had brought up for them. And that was a privilege. Before we went on that visit, the wives and the husbands had both filled in transcultural literacy questionnaires and given each other feedback. Now, I've got many stories from that work. But what was really important was right from the word go, I wasn't asking who's my clients in this organization. I was asking, who does this organization serve? Well, actually who they serve is the 2.5 million people who are economically dependent in South Africa on the fruit industry. Who they serve is the retailers around the world and the people who consume the fruit. Who they serve is rural sustainability. And because I was focused on that, and because I made that clear to the CEOs of the two organizations and the one of the merged organization, to the chairman, to the board, I was in partnership with them. I could be very, very challenging because they knew I wasn't challenging because I somehow had the answers or knew better. I was challenging because we were to shoulder, neither of us knowing how to deal with these challenges, but both knowing that we were in service of South Africa sustaining rural sustainability. So by having that bigger stakeholder constantly in the room, it made our work far more radical, far more transformative. So I hope that gives a sense. I know that's on a very, very large scale. I'll tell a very different story. I was working with a very large financial company. I was supporting the top team, coaching the top team as a team to lead a massive cultural transformation. They were going through a major change in how they were operating as a company. And I was rung up by somebody saying, look, Peter, the whole culture change has been blown out of the water by the CEO. And I said, how? He said, well, he's come out of his office. He had a temporary PA because the other one was off sick. This temporary one was pregnant. She fell asleep at her desk and he shouted and swore at her. And that story has gone right around the organization and is so against the values that we as a top team came up with. Nobody has any trust in this culture change. And they said, you need to sort it out. So in good coaching style, I played it back to them and I said to the two people around me up, No, it's your responsibility. You need to take some team responsibility and challenge your team leader. And they said, look, Peter, it may be your biggest project on the line, but this is our career on the line. We need your help. I had to go and have 3 sessions of supervision very quickly and urgently, right? Before I'd worked through all my fury with that CEO, with my wanting to go in heroically and take him on, or my wanting to avoid and saying, look, it's not my responsibility. until I could get to a place of ruthless compassion, where I could be compassionate for him, for the women he was bullying and reactive to. I could be compassionate for the wider organization, compassionate for the members of his team who were finding it difficult to stand up to him and wasn't coming. You know, I noticed that my first reaction was, how dare you? How dare you wreck my culture change program? I thought, well, now that's interesting, Peter. And I caught my own, you know, this isn't the transformation we're doing together for your stakeholders. It's something I'm doing. I had to work through all of that before I could go in, because I knew unless I entered that room, compassionate for all those parties, but absolute clarity that we need to address this, but with not from a critical judgmental place, we couldn't do it. I had to do it in the first sentence. I had to go in and say from my heart, but with absolute clarity. And I was shaking as I went in, very large company, international. I said, look, I'll change his name, George. Before we leave here today, you and I together need to address how your reputation for misogyny is spiraling and growing exponentially around this organization. We need to sort that for the sake of you, your team, the organization, and the work we're all doing together for your stakeholders. And then I had to take a big pause as I watched him get red and his jaw clenched and everything. Before we finished, I discovered that he had a very sick wife who was in hospital and he'd told none of his colleagues about. He had been sent to boarding school when he was seven because he had a very sick mother. So the whole area of women and illness was such an overwhelming issue for him that he'd never dealt with. That was causing major issues for the organization. And we never called it coaching, but 2 weeks after that day, he came up to me and said, do you think you and I could sit down every 2 or 3 weeks and just sort out what we need to address? And he rang me one day and said, look, I need to have an urgent conversation with you. I was with another client. The lunch break, I got back to him. He said, listen, I think I've just turned down a very good woman out of my own reactivity. And I just need to talk it through with you before I just stay with that decision or reverse it. And I've just felt so privileged. But the real work was the work I had to do before I went in the room. And that is the spiritual practice we all have to do, which is how do we have wide-angled empathy and ruthless compassion? So let me just offer something for people to take away around that. I'm going to ask you, wide-angled empathy is a lifetime's work. You know, what we're doing is spiritual work. And the teacher that Ram mentioned was the grandson of Hazrat Enir Khan, who was a great Indian musician. He's the one who's got the Dargah in New Delhi near Nizamuddin. And I learned so much from his grandson. And one of the things is this you can practice. You don't need to go to a guru. You can practice this every day. When you watch the news, set a watch on your phone to see how many seconds and how many minutes you can go holding non-judgmental, non-reactive compassion for everyone on the news. Not just every individual, yes, including him, yeah, including her and them, every single person, but every organization, every system, every more than human environmental part. How can you hold the compassion without getting overwhelmed, without becoming heroic or reactive? You know, the best I've ever done is 5 minutes, 20 seconds, but I still practice regularly. If you manage to do more than that, please send me an email and tell me what you're doing that I can learn from, because we all need to be able to do that to become the coaches that the world out there is crying out for. We all need to raise our game. And please remember, when you're doing it, it's not just my grandchildren, those five little people I showed you. It's all our grandchildren that are relying on us to step up and join the revolution to provide the next generation the coaching that's needed. And if you want to, you're welcome to contact me. Join me on LinkedIn. I do regular blogs. The Wise Fool's Guide to Leadership, which for those of you in India know, it's full of Nasreddin stories. The Hoja Nasreddin, the wise fool becoming an executive coach. So I hope my wise foolishness has been helpful to you today. Thank you for joining.
Thanks for tuning in to today's episode. You can listen and subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. We launch new episodes weekly. To learn more about coaching, leadership, and self-development, visit us at coacharya.com. That's coacharya.com. See you next time.